Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to be Different. It's wonderful to have you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, Medium Wave 1548 Satellite Islam, and to those of you on DSTV 826. And we have a wonderful, wonderful guest. But before we talk about that, we've been talking about the weather. Yes, the last few days has been quite topsy-turvy. We've got the extreme heat, and then we go into weather that's like winter, midwinter, and then we come out of that and we know that amongst the casualties has been birds. And this morning we're going to be talking to Kharad, who used to be with Bird South Africa and has been a regular guest from Radio Islam. Hi, good afternoon, Kharad.
Good afternoon.
We've been having topsy-turvy weather, and I know that birds have been the casualty. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, there's. I haven't heard anything this season yet, but I expect things to happen because very often around this time of the year, in the sort of beginning of summer, we get reports of swallows dying off in huge numbers. So what happens is they, you know, swallows use lots of energy when they fly. So when they can't eat for a day because of inclement weather, their blood sugar drops dramatically. And we've had cases of up to 20,000 swallows that died because of very cold conditions and very rainy conditions when they can't fly and they can't eat. So that is something we expect to happen. In my own garden, you are living in Port Elizabeth, I see the young birds coming out of the nest now, and because of our drought here, they don't find enough food. So we supplement them with food in the garden just to keep the families going. But it is not a good situation for anything when you talk about the birds or the frogs or the mammals and even the insects, because the weather is not what it's supposed to be like. We're supposed to have warm summertime, summer climate now with good rains. But as you say, they would feel like total winter. We've had snow in the middle of summer, and nothing is good in terms of the environment for the wild beings out there.
Thank you very much for that. And we know that I've had reports of people coming out and saying in Bloemfontein we've had lots of swallows dying because of the extremities of weather last week.
Yeah, oh, that happened then, yeah. I'm not surprised. It's supposed to happen. I haven't had reports yet, but I'm not surprised about this.
Now, you know, we're going on to, and I beg your pardon, last week we had lots of people heading out to do some bird spotting on Bird Day, and Birding Day was a big event that happened last week. Tell us something about Birding Day and how did it come about?
Birding Day or Birding Big Day has always been a hype thing in South Africa. That's where the birders get all the binoculars out and all the bird books and they head off into the wild. And they normally start, let's say on a Friday evening, 12 o'clock. Spot on, and they start doing a survey of the birds within 50 kilometers from the central point, and they work that very hard until the next evening at about 12 o'clock, well, if they can endure that, and they try and record as many birds as possible in 24 hours. Now, at the time when I was still working in the bird arena with BirdLife SA, we had a couple of grand events, and people managed to clock up anything between 250 and nearly 400 birds in the 24 hours, which is astounding if you think that we've got about 900 species in the country. So some people manage to clock up nearly 50% of all the species in 24 hours, but it takes a massive amount of planning and hard work and lots of traveling and coordination between the team, and the team only consists of nothing more than four people. So the team is not allowed to break up. So if you have a team of four, the team has to stick together. So same with a team of three. You have to stick together, and at least two people in the team have to identify the bird either visually or then by sound or a mixture of sound and vision. So it's hard work, but it's enormous fun. And I remember the one year I was down with my team in KwaZulu-Natal in the famous Nkudu Reserve. We got, I think, over 300 species, but, man, the work was hard. And by 9 o'clock that next evening, we were totally shot. There was no way we could continue at 12 o'clock and we call it a day, but it was still enormous fun and excitement that you have when you find the next species. And the disappointment where you work for an hour, you don't find anything new. It's something that everybody has to experience, and I think everybody who's got any knowledge about birds, even if it's scant knowledge in the bird book and a pair of binoculars, should consider that again for the future.
Thank you very much for that. Now, when I looked at some of the stats coming out last year, and does this surprise you that the bird that was spotted was the Hadeda ibis? That is most commonly recorded. Is that a surprise to you?
No, I'm not surprised. If you said to that maybe 25 years ago, I would have said, yeah, it's unusual. But, you know, with all the urbanization of people and all the new gardens popping up, and we created these man-made forests in places like Johannesburg and Cape Town and all over the show, the harida is a highly adaptable species. It's a commensal species. In other words, they love to live in association with mankind, and with all the big trees in the urban areas, they've been able to move out of traditional areas which used to be the Western Cape into virtually every single town and city in South Africa, and that's why people spot them. Now, I also get the complaints in summertime about 4:30 in the morning when the birds start waking up. You know, if a sparrow wakes up, it's a quiet little noise, but if a harida wakes up, it does massive noise, and they normally band together up to 15 birds in a shot. Now, you can imagine if you're sleeping quietly at 4:30 in the morning, summer morning, and 15 birds wake up, and they all chat each other, and that, wow, wow, wow. It's a huge noise, so that's why people record them so easily, because they're loud mouth and they advertise themselves with their loud voices.
And I must tell you that, again, my own, you know, when I see this harida, it's something that's got something about a prehistoric bird. Could you tell me why that happens? You know, when you see it flapping its wings and comes down, and I'm thinking of, you know, in the age of the dinosaurs, those type of huge birds, and when I see this harida coming down, I think, is it coming around to land on my head or something?
No, I think it's the combination of the long beak and the round wings and the funny appearance. When you see them flying, they look like one of these pterosaurus dinosaurs that lived about 65 million years ago, with the long beaks and the round wings. So that's why it creates an impression of a very, very ancient bird. But it's not a really ancient bird. They are not more than about, I would say, maybe 20 to 25 million years old in the history of modern species. But I agree with you. The impression you get when you see them flying is a prehistoric bird. And also something very interesting about them. If you don't know what's flying very far away from you, but you suspect it's a harida, you look at the flight pattern. In other words, they flap the wings. It's not, you know, with a cattle eagle, they've got a gentle, continuous motion, up and down, up and down. The harida flaps three or four times and they glide. They flap three or four times and they glide. So that's one of the best ways to spot a harida far away from you, if it doesn't advertise itself with a big mouth. So it's an easy bird to identify in flight, even if they're far away from you.
And the other surprise for me was the Egyptian goose coming in second. I thought perhaps you'd have the mask weaver or the miner or some of those birds, and I now suddenly see the Egyptian goose. Why would that be?
They've also been able to adapt in the human environment. And you must understand, if you're an Egyptian goose, the place you breed is normally up in a tree. Now, there are sufficient trees in the urban areas, but every single city in South Africa or town has a tall building or a high building. And they love to breed in the crevices in the buildings and also on the windowsill. So it's not surprising that they are so common. They've also expanded their ranges and also the numbers significantly. Now, I know farmers sometimes have a problem with them, where they descend upon newly planted wheat fields and maize fields, and there can be as many as 4,000 in those wheat fields, and they come and eat the new germinated seed and stuff like this. So they can become a problem. And I know when I was still up in Joburg, the golfers complained a bit about them, because they come into the golf and the place where you, I don't know what you call it, I think it's a green, where you hit your balls off to the next hole. And they defecate in that, and the guy said, but you walk around in your shoes, these expensive golf shoes are green and white with a bird poop. So I had to make a plan on the one golf estate to chase them off. And it took me about, I think, 6 days, going out in the morning just before 4 o'clock, and I used these big bomb crackers that we're not allowed to use anymore. And I fired those at them from a long distance with a catapult. And with a noise, I was able to get them off the golf course. Yeah, but they are highly commensal with mankind. And we've got all these ponds and all these water bodies in town, plus the trees to breed in, plus all the high buildings. So they benefit from that greatly, because we've created a perfect environment for them, and also lots of food in terms of all the gardens and all the greenery, because they eat fresh growth of plants like aquila lawns and stuff. So not surprising that they're very common in the bird lists.
Now, when you talk about these were true birds, and I was really, you know, looking out for the miner. Miner doesn't feature very high, but it's also a bird that's become very invasive and, you know, all over in all our gardens.
It is highly invasive. You know, they even find them now in the Kruger National Park. I was surprised when I went there a couple of years ago to see them displaying themselves in a place like the Skukuza, the main camp in the Kruger National Park. So, yeah, It's an invasive bird, and many people call from all the country and they complain about them and they want us to make a plan to eradicate. But that species has now reached the level that to control them is going to be impossible. To exterminate them is going to be completely impossible. So it's something we have to live with. And maybe my attitude changed a bit towards them. In the beginning, I was very antagonistic towards the miners. But, you know, when I lived in Joburg, they were in the garden. And what I found about them was they're very comical. If they have a fight, the whole family comes down. And it was at one stage in my garden, they were fighting. And they fell between my feet. And I picked up a bundle of four fighting miners with my hands.
Wow.
And they were fighting so fiercely that they didn't mind about me picking them up. So I spoke to them. I told them, listen, guys, if you want to fight, not in my garden, be civilized. And I let them all go. But, and on top of that is they are super intelligent. If you talk about intelligence amongst the birds, it's going to be very hard to beat a miner. So, yeah, maybe one should just appreciate them, because the chance of us eradicating them, I think, is long, long gone. So just enjoy them. Enjoy their song. They got a highly varied types of communication calls they use, and yeah, they're invasive, but they're not that bad, really.
I'm also part of a group that's trying to rehabilitate, you know, the wetlands, and one bird that surprised us was the blue crane. How does the blue crane come into our wetlands?
Man, the blue crane, I still have a bit of concern about the blue crane, because we've had a number of very bad poisons over the last 3 or 4 years. There was a case in the Karoo where we know 200 birds were poisoned, and possibly up to 1,000 were poisoned by a very unscrupulous landowner. And just about a month ago, there were 36 poisoned in the Western Cape. But they seem to be, if I can call it, on the rebound, because many people report them, like in the Northwest Province, which is there around just north of Joburg, man, in the area of Koster and those places, where I used to see them in my young days in the 70s. They seem to be coming back in there. And I recorded the last sighting that I caught in the Magaliesberg was about 1986. And all of a sudden people say, but they hear them again in the area, and they see them coming back into the wetlands. And maybe that's a sign of a recovering environment, because the blue crane is insectivorous bird. So if you've got the much poisoning going on in the environment, much pesticides, they can't make it. But maybe because we're moving to a more greener environment, they're coming back into areas, and it's always a joy to hear from people when they see them. And I get many SMSs and WhatsApp from people who travel on the long roads, and they send me pictures of them in the Karoo and the Free State and parts of Gauteng and Mpumalanga, those places, and even in the Northern Cape, in the Kalahari, they spot them around Postmasburg, which to me is good news. So I think maybe we are lucky enough to have our national bird on the recovery road to a better population, because remember, the total population is about 25,000 birds, and they're all in South Africa, apart from maybe, I think we talk about 16 pairs up in Namibia, you know, Atoshapan area. So that's about all we've got. But I think they might be recovering slowly but surely.
So that's very good news. Now let's look at some of the more, you know, common garden species. We seem to find a lot of hoopoe and woodpeckers out in Gauteng. Is that their natural habitat in the gardens?
Yeah, remember, if you read the old scriptures from the areas from Mesopotamia and the Middle East, from Israel, Jordan, Palestine, those places, it's always, wherever you talk about ancient scriptures coming out of any languages out there, there's always the mention of the hoopoe. Now, the hoopoe, back in the old days, before there was the establishment of Judaism and Islam and Christianity, that was regarded as an iconic species and a sort of magical species. The old shamans from the old land, they revered the hoopoe as a very wise bird because of its call, because of its beak, and because of its commensal living with mankind. And when I spent time in the Middle East, we always found them in the Negev Desert, in those places, living in crevices in the old buildings that were built by the ancient cultures. So they come a long time with humankind, about 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. And even in the Egyptian hieroglyphs, you find scriptures of the old drawings of the hoopoe out there. So hoopoe is perhaps one of the oldest birds associated with mankind, apart from the peregrine falcon and maybe one or two of the owl species. So yeah, and again in the gardens, they've got a good time, because they find holes in nesting locks and trees and stuff like this. And of course, in the gardens, the green lawns and stuff, lots of insects to eat. So I enjoy them very much. They come into my garden also. And if you call them right with your own call, they respond to you. And this time of the year, you should look out for them with young, because they fledge the young right now. So we, just as long as you make sure you don't use too much or the wrong pesticides in the gardens, they can live in your garden for a long time.
Just give us a hoopoe call. How would that sound? I'm trying to just distinguish the call. How, what would it sound like? All right.
It's basically just a whoop, whoop, whoop that they call. And the whoop, the call is, sounds very soft, but it carries very, very far. And if you can whistle like that, and I can't do it now because my lips are sore from infections, but you can call them up and respond well to the call. What I enjoy about them, if you sit in the garden and you conduct yourself very calmly and quietly, they will walk right up to you under your legs while feeding and feeding the young. As long as you don't make quick movements, they will stay very close to you. So it's one of the birds, if you know how to handle them, they will become very tame around you. And what I did in my younger days when I lived in Joburg on my own, I fed them mealworms, and they loved it. They brought the young to come and feed, and I very often had a pair in my garden with up to two young that came to feed around my chair.
And what about the woodpecker? I know I saw some of them, and I must say to you, amazing birds when you see them coming in, and quite graceful.
There are two types we find in the gardens. The woodpeckers, which are the ones that are mainly a drab color with a golden tail and with a red head, or the black head. And then you've got the barbets, like the black-collared barbet, which is very common in your area in Joburg, and also the crested barbet. Now, these all animals have also benefited hugely from mankind's activities in terms of our afforestation of the cities and all the big trees we've got. So wherever there's a little hole in the tree, they would use that. And many people put up these nesting locks for them to make out of sisal stumps. So in my garden, one stage we had, I think, two pairs of the black-collared barbets and three pairs of the crested barbets that used the nesting holes. And they also became quite tame. And those ones, one fed with a mixture of suet, which is the fat mixture, plus some fruit seeds, pieces of apple, and even bits of cheese and bits of meat. So they are omnivorous, and also when you feed them the right way, they become very tame in the garden. It's always nice to wake up in the morning with the prrrr call of the crested barbet and the other one of the black-collared barbet. It's more difficult to see the real woodpecker. They're not very vocal, especially not in town, but what you must listen out for is that drumming on the tree trunks. Remember, they've got two types of communication. They've got the vocal one, which is a nasal call, like meh, and then that drumming on the tree trunk. And every species has got its own rhythm and frequency of drumming. And if you know the drumming, you can identify the bird by listening to that particular one without having to see the bird or without having to listen to the vocal call that they make.
And currently we have a lot of the southern mask weavers building their nests. Tell us something about them. And also, I don't know, someone has once indicated to us that when you're looking at nesting patterns, the higher the nest, it means there's going to be lots of rainfall. If the nests are lower, then you would be in a drier period. Is that correct? And some of, just tell us something about them.
Yeah, I think it's a very good observation to say that looking at the nesting height off the ground surface can tell you something about the pending rainy season. And you're right, if the nests are hanging low, then the chances of lots of rain are not that good. When the nests are built high up, then it means lots of rain, especially when you're close to a water body, like a riverbed or a stream or even a lake or a dam. Then that observation will give you a good idea of what's coming in terms of rain for the future. Now, what the weavers do, they build these nests, and every single weaver species has its own sort of plan for the nest. So you can identify the species without seeing the bird by looking at the type of nest they build. And mostly in the bird books, like the Cecil bird books or the Newman's or whatever else you buy, will have an indication of what the nest looks like. Some of them don't have a funnel. Some of them have a funnel with the inter. Some of the funnels are short. Some of the funnels are long. But what's interesting is in the last couple of years, let's say for the last 8 or 9 years, we've had the mask weavers building these stacked nests, and sometimes they build 3 or 4 nests under each other. So that's a new development, and it shows you there is something to be said about evolution, because it was never found before, And all of a sudden, we found one or two of them in Joburg, and now becomes a common thing. So I think birds evolve over time, and they also learn. So the one guy said, well, let me build a double story to show the wife I'm a really good husband. And the next one said, but let me show you I'm better. I'll build a triple story. And one pulled a quadruple story. So it becomes common now. So birds learn from each other. And I think in 50 years from now, you might find that most of the mast weavers have at least a double story house, just like people do. You know, in the beginning we had little shacks or cave, and then people built a house, and then they built a double story. And if you reach now, you build a triple story. So it depends on how people learn the same thing with birds. And I think it will become commonplace in the future that birds will build different types of nests as they learn from each other on to be a bit more extravagant than the neighbors next door. It's just typical like people.
I was just going to ask that question because I've observed a couple of double story nests. I was wondering, it's quite a new phenomenon. And why are they building this stack? But I wasn't able to take down the nest. And but like you said, it seems to be more common. And that is specifically the mask weaver doing that. Is that right?
It's the mask weavers, yeah. The other ones, like the cape weavers and the others, spectacle weavers, don't really, but the mask weavers, they are the masters of building, and also in terms of these stack nests, yeah, definitely.
The reason why do they build their nests and then break them down? Just tell us something.
Oh, remember the nest building is part of the mating behavior between the male and the female. So the male builds nests to show the female that he's a potentially good mate and a good father for the offspring to come in the future. And when the female's not ready to mate yet, they will break the nest down. It will mostly be instigated by the female. Once you're ready for mating, then she will leave the nest, select the best one of the group he built, and then they will mate, and she will lay the eggs and raise the young. So it's more part of the mating rituals and the nuptial displays, as we call it in English, to show that you can build a proper nest. Otherwise, the female might not consider you. And interesting, if I can latch on to something else, a friend of mine that used to be at Wits University, she's now at Cape Town University, Phoebe Barnard. She did a study on the little pinto wilders, which are also very common in the gardens, and she kept a few. And some of them she cut the tails a bit shorter, and then she took those cuttings and she put them with super glue onto other birds, on the other tails. And then she observed them, how they reacted. And guess what? The males with the shorter tails withered away. They never got any females. The males with the longer tails got all the attention. They got a band of females around them, and they were very successful in the breeding. So it shows you the way the male looks in the bird world is very important on how successful they become in terms of raising progeny and offspring. So maybe in terms of the nest building, also the better nest you build, the better chance of finding a mate, and the better the chance of seeding your genetics for the future into the population.
Thank you very much. We're going to go for a short break. When we come back, we'll continue. Stay tuned. If you just tuned in, my name is Ismail Buryaba, and our program Dare to be Different. It's wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, Medium Wave 1548, Satellite Islam, and on the DSTV bouquet. And this morning we're having a wonderful discussion, fascinating, and that's on birds and birds in the garden. And we've got an expert with us, and that's Gerard, who used to be with BirdLife South Africa. I thank you very much for being with us once again, Gerard. Now, we're wanting to attract birds to our garden. Tell us about some of the ways that we can do that.
I think it always goes back to basics. Remember, we live in South Africa. And unfortunately, especially with the European people, they like to make everything looking like a rose garden in London. No, we're not in London. And being a South African, I'm very staunchly supporting our own indigenous flora. So plant indigenous, whatever you plant. Don't just plant indigenous, but plant indigenous for your particular area. It doesn't help to try and plant fynbos on a high veld where you live in Joburg and places like Lanesia, where most of your listeners listen. You must plant what is in the area, like the particular plants in that area. We've got things like the Korea and stuff like that, which will survive there. But if you plant plants that won't survive, the frost will kill them. So that's the most important thing, plant indigenous. And then amongst indigenous plants, select trees that will bear the fruit, like the dune berry. They bear the fruit, and things like the white stink would bear the fruit that the birds will eat. So you don't have to feed them artificial food. The natural plants that you plant will feed them. Okay, that's the first point. Secondly, all birds love water. First of all, to drink and then to bathe. So make a couple of watering points. And I think it's always a good idea to have more than one watering point in the garden, because some birds like the olive thrush, now called karoo thrush, I think, or something like that. They dominate the birding bird bath. And if you don't have more than one, you will have an olive thrush sitting there, and it will keep everybody away from the water. So have a couple of different watering spots at low level, at higher level, to give them enough water. And make sure you clean those watering ponds and the baths on a regular basis. Because the birds like fresh water just like us. As human beings, we like fresh water. And then in terms of feeding, I know people say, but one shouldn't feed the birds because you make them dependent. I don't think it's true, because I found with my own test up in Joburg that if you stop feeding, the birds still survive in the garden, and they are still as numerous as you get in the garden, still as diverse you get in the garden. I think the feeding is just to support them to get through difficult times, especially when they're breeding and they have to feed the young. And also, I think it supports them in terms of maintaining their population. So I've got no problem with feeding. And what one should consider is to give them protein and to give them carbohydrates. Now, the carbohydrates can come in the form of bird seed that you can buy from your nurseries and the hardware stores or even from the co-ops. And the protein can come in terms of if you go to your butcher, doesn't matter where you buy your meat from, ask them for those cuttings from the bandsaw, which contains bone meal and some fat and some protein. That makes a wonderful food for any bird that loves the protein. Secondly, you can give them a bit of cheese, if you cut up small bits of cheese, but not too much because it's very often too fatty for them. That would work. And then I think the best way to feed them protein is to make use of mealworms. Now, mealworms, easy to do. You take normal bran that you buy from your local food chain store, and inside the bran you mix a bit of ProNutro, let's say two-thirds bran, one-third ProNutro, and you go to your pet shop and they normally sell mealworms, and you buy a bucket of mealworms and you put them into that. And you cut some apple slices or potato slices once every week, put it on top, and that's their moisture, and they start breeding. And once you've got a colony going, you can harvest a small handful every day and offer that to the birds. So that's also a highly sought-after food source for the birds in your garden. If you do that, you can keep a lot of species going, and you can have a lot of diversity in the garden. And make sure then also that you have different feeding spots, because some birds like the pinto wire will dominate in summer. Some birds like the pigeons will also dominate the entire scene. So if you have different spots, you'll break the domination by one species and make sure everybody gets a bit of the food in the garden. And I think the last thing also important is that if you have a cat, you must teach the cat not to catch birds. Now, that's quite a mission, because cats are very good bird hunters, but I think it can be taught. And then secondly, with your dogs, I think train your dogs not to chase the birds. I've got two small dogs, or my kids have got two small dogs, and we're in the process now of teaching them not to chase the birds, because birds don't like to be chased. And you must have your pets in the garden. You must have your dogs, you can have your cats, and I'm sure if you do it right, you can train them and teach them not to interfere with the birds. So if you do that, you will have a joyful time in your garden with the birds, with your pets. The kids can enjoy them, and everybody will benefit from the birds in the garden.
A question coming through with regards to, could you give them cooked rice?
Yes, yeah, cooked rice. I think it's important to make sure that when you offer them anything like that, the rice must be, I think, fairly soft. Otherwise, rice is too hard to eat. Cooked rice will be good for them. But important, when you want to give them breadcrumbs, make sure you dry them up properly, because if the bread is too moist, it might grow fungus because of the yeast in the bread. It might not be good for the birds. So I know my dad, when he was still alive, used to feed the birds really tons of bread, but he always broke it up in crumbs, dry the crumbs out and offer that to them. And the birds went ballistic for that, especially the weavers and the sparrows. They love the breadcrumbs like that. So and that you can definitely offer to them.
Just give us a recipe again for the mealworm. How much ProNutro to how much bran?
If you take two-thirds bran and then one-third ProNutro, you mix it up properly in a shallow bowl, and you normally take a plastic bucket, let's say 20-liter plastic bucket or a shallow dish, and you put it in that. And then once you've got the mealworms in there, I think about once a week, if you cut a potato or an apple in thin slices and put that on top, and they come and they eat that also. You can also do it with lettuce leaves, but I found the potato cuttings and the apple cuttings to be the best. And it takes about, let's say, 6 weeks to get a colony going where they breed and produce new mealworms, and you harvest that and you leave the beetles, because the beetles mate, they lay eggs, and they become extend become the mealworms. If you do it that, you can have a colony going for a long time. And then once every 6 months, you clean it out completely. You take out the mealworms, you take out the beetles, you start a new breeding medium with new brand and new pronutro.
And would that be good enough for winter and summer, or is this just a summer feed?
No. That goes throughout the year. For winter feed, summer feed, throughout the year.
Okay, question that always comes through is doves and pigeons. They become very pissed. You know, they are, how do we control them, and what's the best way of eradicating them from the gardens?
I don't think we can control them. We can't eradicate them because you're not allowed to shoot them, and it doesn't make sense to shoot the birds. The best mechanism to control them, if you want to call it that, in the garden, is to have different feeding spots and different watering spots. Now, many people just take bird food and put it on the ground, on the grass, or on the bare spot. That's where you create the conflict, where all the pigeons come in and they feed it. If you make yourself a couple of feeding trays by just taking a piece of wood or an old lid from a food tin or a cookie tin or stuff like this, and suspend it on a branch in the tree or somewhere under the eaves of the house, then you've got suspended ones that are movable. The small birds can feed them, the pigeons can't feed them because they can't land it, and that way you create a situation where everybody's got a chance to feed in the garden. If you go to the bigger nurseries, which I'm sure are around you, and even the border squares, they do sell commercially made bird feeding stations, and if you want to spend the money and you buy those, let's say 3 or 4, that'll be sufficient for the garden. And then you put normal food, the cheapest food, on the ground. That's where the pigeons will go. But the more expensive food, like the suet and the mealworms and stuff, you put that on suspended bird feeders, then the small birds can benefit from that, and you don't have the conflict between the bigger birds dominating the smaller birds in the garden.
How do you prevent pigeons from nesting in the eaves of your house?
The only way to do it is to keep an eye open when they start nesting, to break down the nest. There's nothing else you can do, really.
Okay, and I'm also reading something here. It says that to give them sugar water, how would that work?
Sugar water is mainly for the sugar birds.
What's
okay, or for the sun, for the sunbirds.
Okay.
What you can do, I think at some of the nurseries, they do sell the bottles which are specially made for feeding the sunbirds. But you can try yourself. If you take the 500 ml cooling bottle, like a Coke bottle, and you drill a small hole into the lid of that, and you put a small pipe into that. But I'm talking about a little tube, and you can use something like a stainless steel tube or a copper tube, which is about a 3 millimeter diameter, and to put that into that. Then you fill it up with sugar water with a bit of colorant. You take the red food colorant that the women use for making sponge cakes and all the red velvet cake and stuff like that. You put that into the water, and you make quite a syrupy water. Let's say about 5 tablespoons of white sugar in a liter of water to make it syrupy, and you fill the bottle right to the brim, put the lid on with a tube in it, and then you suspend that sort of at an angle of 45 degrees downwards, and that will create enough of a small drip that the birds can land on the tube, drink off the tube, and then go forth. And that works very well for the sunbirds in the garden. The other birds don't come and feed in that because they're not really nectar drinkers, but the sugar birds or the sunbirds will most definitely go for that.
Now, I know we spoke about how to attract, birds into your garden. Any other watch points? Because we have a lot of young people who may wanting, to go in that direction and bring more of that. What else, what other advice do you have for them?
There's a lot of things. First of all, any garden, wherever you are in the country, and with normal plants and with flowers and with fruit trees and maybe some vegetables, will have some pests. And I always tell people, the worst thing you can do is to attack the garden with a blanket spray of pesticide and kill all the insects in the garden. Because if there are no insects, there's no life in the garden, and you can't expect the birds to come to a lifeless garden. So when you have to do any pest control in your garden, do it only for that particular plant where you find the pest. And don't just spray the stuff. If you have to buy a pesticide, I welcome people to send me a WhatsApp or an SMS to ask me what they should use on what plant for what pest. And I will tell them always what is going to be the least impact way of doing it. In other words, the least toxic chemical to use to control the pests, so that you can control the pests without harming the biodiversity in the garden. But this idea that we see very often, that people go and spray the entire garden with a pyrethroid or organophosphate, that's completely out, because nothing will survive in that garden. Secondly, is to maintain the other forms of life in the garden along with the birds, like all the geckos, the lizards. Even if there's a snake or two in the garden, the frogs are very important, the other insect life in the garden very important, not to kill anything which is not supposed to be killed. And yes, people complain about spiders, but remember, spiders are very important, and they're also food for many of the birds. Things like sunbirds eat spiders, and even things like the black-eyed bulbuls, which are very common, they would eat spiders. So don't kill them, because they're part of the biodiversity and part of the food chain. And then I think lastly is this booming quest of all people, of all cultures, to have owls in the garden. Very important. You can put an owl box up, and I recommend that people go and look at the JoJo tanks. They make a beautiful owl box out of plastic, which it does cost a lot of money, but they will last you 30 or 40 years. And you put that up, there's a very good chance, especially in the Joburg area, that you will get a pair of barn owls or a pair of spotted eagle owls into that box to come and live in your garden. But alongside with that, remember then, if you do have to do rat control, then again, you must actually send me a WhatsApp on SMS, and I'll tell you which of the rodenticides to buy and how to apply it, but you can still kill rats without posing the risk of poisoning to the owls. So these are things that people should look out for. And then when young people start moving to a house and they have to buy themselves a pet, make sure that you buy a dog which is not going to be chasing the birds around. Jack Russells are very cute dogs, but they're very lively and they become a real menace with birds. So if you want to have a Jack Russell, from a young age, teach these things that the birds are totally off-bound. And believe me, I'm sure with whatever breed of dog you buy, you can teach them not to chase the birds down and not to catch the bird. The same with a cat. And if people don't believe me, I lived in a house with two friends of mine many years ago there in Melville. And they had a little doggy, which was a Maltese poodle, and they had two cats. And we taught them not to chase the birds, not to hunt the birds. And they worked perfectly well in the garden. There was no conflict between the pets and the birds in the garden. So I think these things are important to consider if you want to get into garden and start gardening for the birds also.
And a book, which book do you recommend if a person wants to start with bird watching, garden birds? What do you recommend?
That's a very personal thing, but we've got so many good bird books in the market, and I'm one of the suckers. I buy every single one on the market. I don't care who makes it, which language. But I always like the Cecil one, the Newman's one, which is very good, the one from Breezer, from Ulrich Oberfeld is a good one. There's so many good bird books on the market. I think you should go to a place like Exclusive Books and stand in front of the bookshelf and look at all of them and decide for yourself what matches your eye. Some of them have drawn pictures. Some of them have photographs. It's a personal choice. And remember, there's also now the new Roberts bird books with the drawings that you can buy, and they even break them down into geographical regions. So it's a very much a personal choice. I can't tell you which one is the best because I got them all. You won't find a single bird book in the bird store which is not on my shelf at home.
Are you still doing lots of bird watching in Port Elizabeth? Is that as exciting as when you were down in Johannesburg area?
No, unfortunately the bird life in Joburg is vastly better than in Port Elizabeth in terms of diversity. So we don't have the diversity down here in our gardens that you find in Port Elizabeth, but we've got exciting stuff. When we moved down here, the first bird I heard at night was the fighting niger. Now that's a total iconic African species for me, and I was very surprised to hear them around. So we hear them summertime all around the house. We've got natural shelters, so we hear them very, very often. And then the exotic type of birds, like the blue, the blue turaco, the luri, we find them down here. So these are, we've got specials down here, but if you want to see diversity, man, it will be very, very hard to beat Joburg as an urban area for any place in the country. So Joburg is diverse with life. And I remember when I lived up there, I had in my garden in Randburg 113 bird species recording in less than 9 years. So that is not bad, not bad at all.
It's phenomenal, I would think. And finally, before we round up, just quick, what is the bird of the year?
No, I don't know.
You don't know, not a problem. And could you perhaps, your address where people can contact you if they have any of these particular queries or questions?
Yeah, I think the easiest now is to use the WhatsApp because it's a fast medium and people can even send me a picture. So my number for that is
082-446-8946. 8946. And that is Gerard for any queries, any questions related to any aspect of birding.
Yeah, birding, and also if people have a pest to control, I would welcome them to call me or to WhatsApp me before they do it because I'm giving them advice on to do it environmentally responsibly.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very informative. I've enjoyed it thoroughly and I've learned so much. You take care, Gerard, and we'll be chatting to you again. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Keep well.
You take care. Thanks, Tabba. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And there's Gerard giving us lots of information about birds in the garden and how you could attract them, how we could interact with them, and also spoke about the different type of species that we would get. And if you'd like to any further information, you can get Gerard on his WhatsApp, the number 082-446-8946, 082-446-8946. It's all for me. I'm to meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.